Hi, this is Dr. Tina Webb, and you are listening to the Coping Season Podcast, the show that discusses mental and emotional wellness to help Black men and Black women begin to heal and cope with the effects of emotional distress. Although I am a licensed clinical social worker, please note that this podcast is not meant to be used as a substitute for a relationship with a licensed therapist. Get ready to laugh, think, and be entertained. It's time to cope. Let's get started. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Wednesday. I'm so glad to be here with you. And I know I say the same thing every week, but it is so true. I'm really happy to be here. And we have a lot to talk about today. So let's just get right into it. How many of y'all know Meg Thee Stallion? She's a rapper and she sings that song, I'm a Savage. Hey, classy, bougie, ratchet, sassy, moody, nasty, acting stupid, what's happening? What's happening? Ay, hips tick tock when I dance. On that demon time, she might start on OnlyFans. Big B and that B stand for bands. If you want to see some real ass, baby, here's your chance. I say left cheek, right cheek, drop it low and then swing. Texas up in that thing, put you up on this game. Y'all done got me started. Don't get me started, y'all. As y'all can see, I am a huge fan of Meg Thee Stallion. And by the way, that was the Beyonce version. So, you know, it really broke my heart last month when I found out that Meg Thee Stallion had gotten shot. She's 25 years old and, you know, she was shot in both of her feet. She had to get surgery to get the bullets out. And luckily, no bones or tendons were hit, but she was shot multiple times in her feet. And we don't know the details of who shot her, why, or anything like that. But people are saying that she was shot by Tory Lanez, who is also a rapper, a singer, a producer. And, you know, I'm a fan of his, too. And people are saying that he did it because he was with her that night that she was shot and he ended up getting arrested for having possession of a firearm. So people are just putting two and two together and, you know, we don't really know. And Meg has been pretty tight-lipped about it too. And maybe because it could be because it's an ongoing investigation. Who knows? But what she has shared is that she says she suffered gunshot wounds as a result of a crime that was committed against her and done with the intention to physically harm her. So whoever shot her did this on purpose. It wasn't an accident. She has shared multiple times that she is traumatized. She said that she's hurt. She's traumatized. It was a traumatic night and it was super scary and the worst experience of her life. Now, like I said, I'm a huge Meg Thee Stallion fan. So it really hurt to hear that this happened to her because let me tell y'all about Meg Thee Stallion. First of all, not only is she a rapper, but she's also a health administration student at Texas Southern University. She has said many times that she is using rapping as a stepping stone because she wanted to start businesses. She wants to establish assisted living facilities in her hometown of Houston, Texas. So she has dreams and goals beyond just rapping and twerking, you know, and she suffered so much loss and trauma in her life already. Like her father died when she was 15. And then last year, 2019, her mother died from a brain tumor. And then 2 weeks after her mother died, her grandmother died. So it's like she's experiencing trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma. And it was just heartbreaking last week. She got on Instagram and she was tearful. She was crying. She was saying that, you know, imagine being 25 and not having your parents or family like that, because she was close with her family. And basically now she's famous. She's hanging out with all these new people. And she said she was moving too fast. She wasn't taking enough time for herself. And she thought that she was ready to give her good energy to other people, but other people weren't ready to give good energy to her. She said she had to sit down and pray on it and that this whole experience was an eye opener and a blessing in disguise. And of course, she said she hates that it took this experience for her to learn how to protect her energy. But I think that we have all been in situations like this. You know, you might have been going through something and you haven't healed from it. But instead of working on yourself and dealing with it, you throw yourself into like meeting new friends, into hanging out, into dating. And you get around people who really don't have your best interests in mind. They don't care about you like that. They don't know you like that. And then you might get into situations with them like this that are damaging to you, that are harmful to you. You know, I just hope that my Meg has people around her. And yes, I said my Meg, because I really like that girl. You know, I just wish I could give her a hug, but I hope that she has people around her that are genuine, that love her, that have her best interest in mind. And hopefully she can go and get therapy or get help to deal with some of these traumas that she's been dealing with. It's important. Now, also last month, I don't know if you guys know, but Ricky Smiley, he's a comedian. You know, he also has his own radio show, the Ricky Smiley Morning Show. And he did that skit back in the day, Little Daryl. Well, his 19-year-old daughter, Erin Smiley, she was shot as well. She was in Houston and she was with her boyfriend and they were driving to Whataburger to get a burger. And they were waiting at a red light. She said that there was a car already in the middle. And then a car pulls up on the right lane, and then they just started shooting. They were shooting at the car in the middle, and she just was an innocent bystander, just caught in the crossfire in her car at the light. That was just a really scary experience. And, you know, she didn't even realize she had gotten shot. She thought it was fireworks at first because this happened the day after the 4th of July. And, you know, she said that when the shooters got out of the car, it didn't register for her at first that they were about to shoot people. So when the bullets went through the car, you know, she didn't realize what was happening. It felt like she had gotten burned. And, you know, she said it was hot, it was quick. And it wasn't until her boyfriend pointed out the bullets in her legs that she realized she had been shot. And then she went and she shared a picture on Instagram of the seat that she was sitting in, her passenger seat in the car, and it was just soaked in blood. So she got shot 3 times. She has nerve damage. And then there were other victims too, like in other cars and just out there. And they drove themselves to the hospital. And they survived as well, which was a blessing. And, you know, his daughter said this was the most terrifying thing that's ever happened to her. And the bullets that went through her legs were hollow points. And, you know, those bullets are made to go through anything. And that's how it went through the car. And it's just a blessing that she's alive, because one of those bullets would have went through her head, but it got lodged in the car instead. And, you know, we don't think about this, but what's also scary is that she got shot and it's a pandemic right now. She got shot during COVID-19. So she's in the hospital and she wasn't able to see her parents at the hospital. She was terrified. Imagine being a teenager that just got shot. You're all alone in the hospital and doctors got you in surgery and you can't have visitors and they won't let anybody in because it's a pandemic. How horrible. And Ricky Smiley, you know, he posted an emotional video and he was just saying, you know, his daughter is in surgery. He can't get to her. He doesn't know what to do. We got to stop gun violence. Parents shouldn't have to go through this. His daughter isn't in a gang. She didn't do nothing wrong. She ain't bother nobody. And he shared that she keeps crying because she doesn't understand why this happened to her. It's just really sad. I'm just glad that she and Meg survived. And I don't know if you guys know this, because I didn't know at the time, but Ricky Smiley is also a gunshot victim. And his father was murdered when he was 7 years old. Now, Ricky Smiley, he got shot in 1995. He was 25 when he got shot and he was in Birmingham, Alabama. And during that time, he was on BET. He was on Def Comedy Jam. He had just gotten married. So things were really good for him. And at the time he was driving in his car, he saw his friend at the payphone, because, you know, we didn't have cell phones back then. So he pulled over to talk to him and invite him to his comedy show. And he said when he got out of the car, he noticed out of the corner of his eye, 3 guys were walking up, and one of them pulled out a 12-gauge shotgun from under his jacket and pointed it at his friend's chest. They were trying to rob him. And Ricky Smiley's friend put up his hands and he was just like, you know, I don't have anything. And then the guy at point blank range, he didn't even say anything to Ricky Smiley. He just pointed the shotgun at him and pulled the trigger. And he just shot him more than once. He got shot in his left side and in his elbow. And after he got shot, he took off running. He almost got hit by a car because he was running across a busy intersection. And when he was running, he heard 2 more gunshots, and he said he ran for his life. He was bleeding. He was panting, and he ran and he knocked on somebody's door and he was yelling, "Help me, help me." But nobody came to the door. So he ran and he didn't know how far he ran, but blood was just leaking and he just felt his life slipping away. And he just collapsed in the street because he couldn't run anymore. And he let out 1 more scream and he yelled, "Somebody help me." And 2 guys just happened to be sitting on a porch drinking beer down the street, and they heard him. And one of the men just happened to be a nurse. So they saved his life. And, you know, when Ricky Smiley talks about the incident, he just talks about how traumatic it was for first of all, a stranger to come along and fire a buckshot into your body. And now it's so traumatic because your grandparents got to look at you laying in the hospital bed. His grandparents had to look at him laying in the hospital bed and be reminded of their son who was murdered, and how traumatic it was for his mother to receive a phone call saying that her only son had been shot. Now, the guy who did it, he was known in the neighborhood for robbing people. Him and his crew, everybody knew he did it. And one day, Ricky Smiley's cousin ran into the guy on the street. He pulled out a gun. He put the gun to the guy's head, and Ricky Smiley's cousin was crying. He was almost about to pull the trigger, but somebody talked him out of it. Somebody eventually, you know, tipped off the police, and those guys ended up were arrested. And the man that shot Ricky Smiley, he was found guilty and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison. And, you know, life can be just such a trip, because do you know that when that man got out of prison, he had a second chance at life and didn't even get to live it because he got killed. He died drag racing in his sister's car. Ain't that something? So the reason why I'm talking about all of this today is because, you know, a couple weeks after Ricky Smiley's daughter was shot, Ricky Smiley posted a video on Instagram while he was at work, and he had to take a break and he walked out to his car. He was on Instagram just very emotional, and he said some things that inspired me to do this episode today. So on today's episode of Ask Dr. Tina, I want to read what Ricky Smiley said on Instagram after his daughter was shot. You know, on the video, like I said, he's walking out to his car. He's saying that he needed to get some fresh air and to vent so he could feel better. It was just a really raw, genuine moment. And he started talking about how when he got the text message from his daughter's mother saying that his daughter was shot, he just sprung into action mode. Like, okay, let me check and make sure that my daughter's okay. I got to give plane tickets. I got to get to Houston. I got to get the family members there who needs to be there. He was dealing with the police reports. He was dealing with returning text messages and phone calls. And he said he was just trying to be the man and, you know, make sure his other kids were okay and just all of that. And then all of a sudden, when he was at work that day, he started feeling anxiety, butterflies in his stomach. And on the video, he was tearful and he was just saying that he doesn't understand it. Now that everything has settled down, it just hit him that this happened to his daughter. He said he was sitting there doing his morning show and almost about to burst out in tears. And this is what he said. I'm heartbroken this morning because it's all settling in. And that's why therapy is important. That's why when you go through trauma like this, you have to get therapy and get help. I'm going to see a therapist today because it not only affects me about my daughter, it conjured up feelings from back when I got shot in 95. And I just can't imagine what my daughter is feeling. My baby don't bother nobody. So these are raw feelings that I'm dealing with and stuff that I'm going through. It's just crazy how the brain work. You be laughing on the outside and crying on the inside. It just F's with your mind so bad, having anxiety all of a sudden. If you go through something, get therapy for it. Just because you work through it and keep yourself busy, that's not the answer. It's good temporarily, but that shit gonna hit you. I started feeling this shit yesterday, and it started making you feel like something wrong with you or some shit. I made this video because I just want people who deal with guns and gun violence to know how it not only affects the person that you shot, it affects all the family members. That's what Ricky Smiley said. So today, in light of everything that has recently happened to Meg Thee Stallion, Ricky Smiley's daughter, Ricky Smiley, and not just them, you know, 4th of July weekend this year, we had so much community gun violence. So many people got killed. Children got killed. So from that Friday through Sunday of that 4th of July weekend, 2020, in mostly black neighborhoods all around the United States, over 500 people were shot and left wounded. And 160 people were killed, shot and killed, including a 6-year-old girl in Philadelphia, a 7-year-old in Chicago, an 8-year-old in Atlanta, and a 15-year-old in New York, all shot. The 6-year-old and the 8-year-old died. And then that same weekend, 31 people were shot in Atlanta, 5 people killed in Atlanta. In Chicago, they had the bloodiest holiday weekend. They ended up having 17 people get shot and killed, including a 7-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy. And not to mention, they also had 63 people wounded from gunshots. And in Chicago, too, they also had recently a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old that got killed during other shootings recently. So in New York, too, over 4th of July weekend, 41 people wounded and from being shot. And 9 people killed. And even as we face a coronavirus pandemic and a civil rights movement, the killings continue, and they are mostly Black victims. Even on Monday night, right here in Los Angeles, some people had a house party at a mansion, Black people, and they were all over the news, and the helicopter was flying over, and they were saying like, oh, look at this party that's happening. Nobody's wearing masks. And, you know, it was more about the pandemic. But then turn on the news the next day, and what do we see? What happened at that house party later on? It was a shooting. Four people got injured and a woman is shot dead. It's just like what Ricky Smiley said. You know, I'm a gunshot victim of my own community. Now my daughter is a victim of our people in our community. I just don't understand it. And he's right. This is just intolerable. And that has been the case for so many of our friends, family, and community members. Many have not survived. They've died, or they've been physically changed for life, paralyzed, brain damage, nerve damage, and so many other effects that come from surviving being shot. Now, when people are shot or they witness a shooting or hear about it, it changes the way people view the world. It makes them feel less secure. It casts a shadow over our lives, especially in the Black community. It affects us not only physically, but mentally and emotionally. So on today's episode, I want to take a deeper dive into the effects of gun violence and trauma and talk about PTSD in the Black community. First, I'd like to say that post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, you know, is caused by many things, not just gun violence. PTSD can develop after any very stressful or frightening or distressing event. And it could be like somebody had a serious car accident, or maybe physical or sexual assault or abuse, including, you know, child abuse, domestic violence. You know, somebody could have been exposed to trauma at work, or they might have serious health problems, like being admitted into the intensive care. That can be traumatic. You know, childbirth experiences like losing a baby, being in the military and being in war and conflict, torture, you know, man-made disasters like a really bad earthquake or a hurricane. There are so many ways that we are exposed to trauma. But today I wanted to focus on gun violence because in the Black community, we have cultural trauma surrounding gun violence. In many of our Black communities, it's an everyday threat. In our communities, gun violence shapes trauma, and trauma shapes gun violence. Like when Ricky Smiley got shot, he got shot by somebody with a gun who was trying to rob him. And then you have Ricky Smiley's cousin. Because he was traumatized by what happened to Ricky Smiley, he used a gun to try to retaliate on the guy who shot his cousin. He wasn't trying to rob him or anything. It was because he was traumatized by what happened to his cousin. And that's why he was crying when he was holding the gun to his head and why he was able to be talked out of it. So gun violence causes trauma. And then sometimes trauma causes more gun violence. And gun violence is just such a broad and complex issue. We have gun violence in relationships with domestic violence, gun violence, you know, in regards to mass shootings, suicides. People use guns in road rage. There are just a lot of ways that guns are used, but I want to focus on gun violence in the Black communities, which normally has to do with homicides, senseless killings, senseless violence that affects our community. There are thousands of young Black men and young Black children that are killed every year due to gun violence. So our exposure to trauma in Black communities is high. And throughout the history of the United States, any laws that have ever come out regarding gun control or restricting guns, it's always came about as a means to deny the right for Black people to own firearms. And that's due to white people's fears that Black people are going to use guns against them because of all the atrocities that they've done to us. And gun control has also been used as a way to, quote unquote, keep Black people in their place. Like in 1751. They had a French Black Code. Basically, it was a law in Louisiana, and it said that the white colonists were required to beat or shoot to kill any Black person carrying anything that could be used as a weapon, like even if it was a cane. And I'm mentioning all this because I think it's important for us to know the history of Black people when it comes down to guns. So when you look at the 16th century, there was this colony of the New Spain, and they were terrified of Black slave revolts. So they prohibited Black people. It didn't matter if you were free, if you were a slave, you could not have a gun. And then in the 1790s, you know, in Haiti, If you don't know what the Haitian Revolution is, the Haitian Revolution was the largest and most successful slave rebellion. So in the 1790s, that's when the Haitian Revolution started, and they ended up ending slavery in Haiti. They overthrew the French. And now when the white slave owners in America heard about what happened in Haiti, they were terrified. So they continued to pass laws to prohibit slaves and free black people from having firearms. When the 1800s rolled around, you know, they disarmed free black militias. They didn't let free black people have positions that require them to have a gun. The government came up with more laws that stopped free black people from having a gun, so they couldn't learn fencing. And, you know, fencing is that that sport that you see people, they have those little swords and they're like going back and forth like clink, 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 clink. And it's a little skinny little sword thingy. So, they made laws that stopped white people from teaching fencing to black people, and black people were not allowed to teach it. So as you can see, there was just this fear of black people being armed, a fear of slaves revolting against slave owners. So they passed laws to disarm all black people. It didn't matter if you were free or a slave. You know, it got so bad that in some states, they even prohibited black people, free black people, from owning a dog without a license because they were scared that black people would use the dogs as a weapon. So they stopped black people from owning dogs, and they authorized any white person to kill an unlicensed dog owned by a free black person. And then in 1831, after, you know, Nat Turner's rebellion, oh, it really was, you know, black people could not own any firelocks. They couldn't own any weapons. They couldn't own any powder, any lead. They couldn't have anything. So it was completely illegal for any free black person to have a firearm. Now, during slavery, they already had what they called slave codes. So slave codes were laws, basically, that prohibited slaves from owning guns. Then after the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, and then the Civil War ended, those slave codes, all they did was change the name. They renamed them and called them Black Codes. And these codes, they were laws, and they were developed to help stop black people who were now free from still not being able to own guns. So slave codes turned to Black Codes, and it's the same law, just a different name. So black people were free, but those Black Codes, you know, they said black people weren't citizens, and we didn't have the same rights as white people, and that the right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment did not apply to black people. And you see this in the Dred Scott decision, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that the United States Constitution was never meant for black people. It was never meant for black people to be citizens. It doesn't matter if you're a slave. It doesn't matter if you're free. The rights and privileges of the Constitution do not apply to black people. And so these black codes were established after the Civil War in the South, you know, because the South, they lost. So they established their black codes basically to reestablish white supremacy. So they dictated what free black people could and could not do. And possessing firearms, having a gun, is something they could not do. So to enforce this gun ban, white men riding around in posses, aka the Ku Klux Klan, they began terrorizing black communities, and they started taking all the guns that they found on free black men. But in the North, after the Civil War, it was a totally different experience. It was like night and day because black people were free. Black people, you know, the black soldiers, they were allowed to take their rifles home. So black people had guns. Black people could buy guns in the North. You didn't have to have been in the military. You can just buy a gun if you wanted to, because they had a lot of guns that were left over from the war because they made a lot. So it was just night and day between the North and the South. And like I said, in the South, they had those black codes. But then in 1866, the Civil Rights Act came about, and they overrode those black codes. So those black codes were supposed to not apply anymore. But black people still were not able to own weapons, because guess what? Black codes are gone. This is what we're going to do. The Southern states, they made it so that black people could not afford a gun. They put high taxes. They banned guns that were cheap and affordable. So you see how I'm telling you, like, how laws have always come about, and they've been enacted to deny rights to black people. And not just for guns. This is for many different type of laws. Now, back then, when black people did have guns, they only used them when necessary to defend our families and communities. So gun control has always historically been a tool of racism. It's always had to do with racist attitudes about Black people's violence. We use them for self-protection, for self-defense from the KKK, and to protect ourselves from violence against us perpetrated by white people. So you see how racism is tied to the history of gun control in America? This has just always been the case. You know, in the 1960s, the Black Panther Party came about and they advocated like no other for the right for Black people to be able to have guns, to bear arms, you know, and to have loaded guns in public. So they would educate the community about our gun rights. You know, and during that time, there was a lot of violence and oppression of Black people by the police. And during that time, too, in the 1960s, our Black leaders, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, they were being assassinated. So Black people had guns to protect themselves. And before Malcolm X was assassinated, you know, he preached against Martin Luther King's nonviolence stand. Malcolm X, he said that because the government was either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of Black people, he said that we have to defend ourselves by any means necessary and as a means of self-defense. So that's why you see these photos of Malcolm X in a suit and tie. He's looking out the window with a gun in his hand. You see these photos of the Black Panthers with their guns out in the open. You know, so in the 1960s and in American history period, Black people couldn't rely on the government for security. We couldn't rely on the government for protection. So Black people started to own firearms. And the Black Panthers, they carried their guns out in the open. It was legal. You could do that then. There were open gun policies. And the Black Panthers, they used those policies to protect Black people that were victimized by the police. They used it as a tactic called cop watching. So they stand out there with their weapons. And it was just to protect Black people from being, like I said, victimized by the police. White America felt threatened by this. Look at these Black people standing out here with these guns out in the open. But everybody else was able to do it. It wasn't an issue or a problem until Black people started to do it, until the Black Panthers did it. So what ended up happening is they passed the Mulford Act. And that law took away the public's right to carry a loaded weapon in public. And that was because, like I said, of the Black Panthers. It was a law that was specifically designed to stop Black people from carrying a loaded weapon in public. So like I said, in American history, gun control measures, like so many other laws, were used to oppress Black people, institutionalized racism, systematic racism. But even in the civil rights movement, you know, Martin Luther King, he talked about nonviolence, but he still had guns. They still had guns to protect themselves. After Martin Luther King Jr.'s house was bombed in 1956, he applied for a permit to carry a concealed firearm. You know, he was denied for it, but his house was always guarded by armed men. He had guns in his house to protect him and his family. So Black people always had guns for protection, you know, and then in 1967, we had the summer race riots. And that was when, you know, over 100 cities in the United States had riots. It's kind of like what's happening right now in 2020. You know, in 1967, they had stores being looted, police cars being burned, damage to property. The National Guard was deployed to our neighborhoods. But during that time, lots of people were killed. Lots of injuries during those riots. And it was because of police brutality, poverty, unfair treatment of Black people. And then after those riots, there came more laws designed to prevent Black people from owning firearms. So laws came out saying who can get a license to carry a gun. So basically, anybody who had a felony, they couldn't get a gun. If you were mentally ill, if you were using drugs, if you were a minor, they were not allowed to own firearms. Now, in the late 1960s, there started to be like these little small, poor quality handguns that started circulating in the Black community. And we started to see more assaults and robberies during that time. And the police, they called these little guns Saturday night specials because they were inexpensive pistols. They were popular in the Black community and supposedly crime would go up on the weekends. So they called them these little Saturday night specials. Now, when the government finds out that they're getting that Black people have access to these guns, they put out gun control laws banning these inexpensive guns so that Black people would not have access to weapons. So in the past, Black people had a hard time getting and keeping weapons. And they mostly had them, like I said, to protect their families, protect their communities, and for self-defense. Now, when the crack cocaine epidemic reared its ugly head into our community, you know, in the late 1980s and the early 90s, violent crimes and murder in the Black community, it went up. Like in 1993, that was the highest level of homicides. And what happened is, you know how I talked about in episode 4 about how in the 80s, the unemployment rate went up, manufacturing jobs went away that Black men used to have. And then when new jobs came, the jobs didn't go to black people. It went to high educated white men. So because of that, because of racial discrimination, systematic racism, Black men were cut off from economic opportunities. So a lot of young Black men were dealing drugs and they were making a lot of money. But then there also came this increased violence and murders in our community, because now the drug dealers had to defend their territory. They had to defend their business. A lot of the drug dealers were gang members. So there were gang wars. You know, people got killed. There were drug wars. And, you know, the people that used crack cocaine, they committed more crimes because they had to feed their addiction. So between 1984 and 1994, gun-related homicides doubled in the Black community, more than doubled. And that was because what was happening also during that time is that there was a boom in handgun production. So more people had guns, and as the gun production went up, so did the killings. Also in the 1980s and the early 90s, there was an increase in low-priced pistols. They were very affordable, which led to higher levels of gun homicide among young Black men. So in 1993, the year that the gun-related murders reached its highest point, guns were cheap. They were $100 or less, and a lot were being made, and a lot were showing up in the Black community. And at that time, in the 90s, you know, violent crime was seen as out of control, and most of the victims were young Black men. So then there came about the war on crime and the tough on crime measures during the Bill Clinton years. Now, in the early 1990s, crime went down and homicides went down. They went down on their own. It was just like something that happened suddenly. And at that time, experts were predicting that, oh, crime is going to be out of control by the mid 90s. We're going to have to do something very drastic because crime is just going to be outrageous. It's going to be so bad. But that didn't happen. And there was this huge drop, like I said, because in the 90s, the demand for crack was kind of withering away and people were getting jobs. But also, too, a lot of Black people were going to prison during that time because of other laws that had been enacted in the 80s. But then in the 90s, after crime was already down, Bill Clinton signed a $30 billion crime bill. And that was the largest crime control bill in the history of the United States. And like I said, it came about because experts have been predicting for years that crime was going to be so out of control by the 90s. So they had started working on this bill. But by the time the 90s came around, the crime wasn't out of control. The experts were wrong. But Bill Clinton still signed this crime bill. And that crime control bill sent a lot of Black people to prison. It implemented the three strikes mandatory life sentencing for repeat offenders. You know, it didn't matter if you sold drugs three times, you're going to prison for life. The bill also expanded the use of the death penalty. You know, it imposed mandatory life sentences for people with three or more felony convictions. There were harsh new penalties for justice involved our youth in juvenile hall and different stuff. So they used a lot of the money to hire 100,000 new police officers. They used almost $10 billion, like $9.7 billion, to fund prisons. You know, that crime bill also expanded the death penalty. They came up with all these other offenses that could go under the death penalty now. You know, about $6 billion of that money did go for prevention programs, but the programs weren't effective. The prevention programs, they had the police recommend what the prevention program should be, not the community, not social workers. So most of the money was really used to punish people. They implemented measures that punished people. It wasn't for rehabilitation. It wasn't for prevention. And during that time, a lot of Black politicians and Black community leaders, they supported that crime bill. Because you got to think, that crime bill, it took like 6 years for it to be implemented, for them to finish working on it. So they started talking about this bill in the 80s when crime was bad and crack was bad and everything was happening. And then the 90s rolled around, the mid 90s come, and they implemented when crime was already low. So, you know, Black people, Black community leaders, they supported it at that time because in the 80s, you know, there was a lot of crime and it was destroying our Black communities. But like I said, when that crime control bill came about in the 1990s, the mid 1990s, crime had leveled off and it wasn't as bad as it was in the late 80s and the early 90s. So that crime control bill was not necessary anymore, but it still got implemented. And a lot of those Black politicians and those Black leaders who supported it, now they feel that it was a mistake because they're saying they wanted better policing. They didn't want more policing. So now we have all these 100,000 police officers in the community. You know, Bill Clinton, he signed a lot of policies into effect that were detrimental to the Black community. That's why when I hear Black people say, oh, Bill Clinton was our first Black president, or Bill Clinton, he was for the people, I get confused because I'm like, do you not know how the laws and the policies that he enacted decimated the Black community and put so many Black people in prison, on death row, just mass incarceration, and the lack of opportunities and rehabilitation when they got out? You know, the prison population tripled in the decades after he implemented that crime bill. So, and that was also during the time in 1996 when Hillary Clinton said that there were super predators in the Black community, that Black kids aren't just kids and gangs. They're the kind of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. She said, we can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we need to bring them to heal and to heal as if they were dogs. And she was talking to a group of white people about Black children when she said this. What she should have did was talk about the deeper issues of why crime was rising and gun violence in the Black community instead of calling Black children super predators. You know, young Black men back then and even now, they are most likely to be perpetrators and victims of gun homicides, not because they're super predators with no conscience, no empathy. Some people don't have a conscience or empathy. They're called sociopaths, antisocial personality disorder. But we don't have a whole community of sociopaths. You know, young Black men are more likely to be perpetrators and victims of gun violence because of repeated exposure that they have to violence in the Black community, because of extreme poverty, because of high unemployment, because of drug and alcohol abuse and other social problems that cause them to feel a sense of hopelessness. So like I've said numerous times before, there is systematic issues, systematic racism, structural racism that contribute to the problems in the Black community. We have communities of people walking around traumatized, people with PTSD not getting treatment. So Clinton's crime bill, which Joe Biden, by the way, helped to write, it led to more prison sentences, more prison cells, more aggressive policing. It's about punishment, not prevention. They didn't try to understand the issues in the Black community and then take that information and try to create more programs or some other way to help stop the violence. All that crime control did was terrorize Black communities and rip apart Black families. So we started to see more gun control, more gun sweeps by the police in Black neighborhoods, and racial profiling. So if you were Black and walking, driving, or whatever, they could stop you just because you look like you would have a gun. And that could be any Black person. They stopping grandparents and working people, anybody who was Black, basically. So there was just a lot of police misconduct, which sets the stage for where we are today in society. So then by the time the 2000s rolled around, the millennium, a lot of those cheap handguns that Black people have been using, they weren't being produced as much. So, you know, without those guns being produced over time, the gun homicide rate among young Black men, it started to go down, you know, and now it's just dramatically increased. And it's just like, you know, we have to come up with a solution because, you know, even though a lot of guns are taken off the streets when people are arrested or when police pull people over, guns are confiscated, you know, it's still really easy for somebody to illegally get another gun. If somebody wants a gun, it's not hard to get one. You know, in fact, it's easier to access a gun in the Black community than it is to get access to mental health services. So in today's day and age, it's just really unfortunate and it's unavoidable that young Black men in our communities will have guns and they don't have opportunity and they still are facing the same systematic issues that we've always faced. You know, gun control in the Black community is a complicated issue because we fought for a long time to be able to have equal rights to bear arms. And even now, with the protests, police brutality, and racial injustice, Black people are buying more guns now, and they're learning how to use them to protect themselves and their families. But on the other hand, we have all of this senseless community violence where innocent bystanders are getting shot and killed. Our Black children and babies are getting killed. People are getting killed still for colors and gang stuff. And people are getting robbed and killed, which is devastating. So the issue of gun use and ownership in the Black community is complex because there are just so many different views about it in the community. And the purpose of this episode is not to say if we should own guns or not. Gun control is a separate issue that needs to have a whole lot of people in our society brought to the table. I just wanted to share the history of Black people and our relationships to guns in America and explain why we started having more community gun violence as the years have gone on. One thing we all can agree on, though, is that gun violence wreaks havoc on our communities. It's an epidemic. It costs us financially and medical costs, funeral costs, income loss, and in the victim's quality of life and their mental health. You know, this repeated exposure to gun violence destroys our families, destroys our communities, destroys our neighborhoods. Our children should not be witnessing murders. They shouldn't be getting shot. They shouldn't be getting killed. Our babies should not have to be sleeping in bathtubs at nighttime because bullets are being fired in the neighborhood. Black mothers should not have to deal with being under the stress of gun violence, and now they're having babies with low birth weight. Our streets shouldn't be so unsafe that our babies can't walk to the store and get an ice cream, or walk to the library, or walk to school without the fear of gun violence. This is not okay. We shouldn't have to live in fear of getting shot. Children can't play in their front yards. Elderly people can't sit on their porches. That's not right. We are a community of people traumatized by gun violence. Not only are the survivors affected, but also the witnesses, the bystanders, the neighbors, all the people who love this person who got shot and killed. Gun violence impacts us all in the Black community, and it causes us stress, depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. We all have our stories and experiences with gun violence that stay with us. You know, I remember when I was about 13 years old, my father took us to visit his aunt. We were in L.A. and he let me and my brother and sister go across the street to the park. I'm the oldest. So I was there. I was watching my brother and sister playing. And I just remember I got this weird feeling and I looked to my left and there was this guy. It happened so fast. I was standing so close too. You know, this guy walked up to this window of a parked car and he just started shooting through the window. I was shocked. I grabbed my brother and sister and we just started running. And it still pops into my head sometimes. I see it clear as day. And I always think, dang, what if he would have shot us when we were running? What if a bullet would have hit me when I was standing next to that car that he was shooting into? I think about that person that he shot. I wonder if he or she died. So, you know, we have these thoughts and they pop up in these experiences. You know, I've experienced sitting in Taco Bell. I'm laughing and talking with my brother and sister. I have a brand new baby. I just had my first child and he's in the car seat. And I walk up to the counter to order a taco. And all of a sudden, this guy hops the counter. He pulls out a gun. He starts robbing the place. I had to go grab my baby and grab my brother and sister and run out of there. I still think about that to this day. You know, one time I went out with one of my cousins. We were in our early 20s and we went to a little hole in the wall and we were dancing and laughing and having a good time. The next thing we know, there's an argument outside and somebody starts shooting from outside the club into the club. There was only one way in and one way out. So we're running to the back. Everybody's running to the back of the club, crawling on the floor, laying on the ground. And the men in the club, they were pulling out guns, standing behind the bars with guns. It was like something out of a movie. I couldn't believe it was happening to me, you know, and they were in the kitchen with guns. It was just guns, all these guns everywhere. I was terrified. I was just praying to God that we didn't die. And we took a big risk because we weren't going to die in this place that only had one way in and one way out. So we ran for our lives. We ran out that front door. The people were yelling for us to not go outside, don't leave. But we did. We took a chance. And by the grace of God, we made it to the car. We were shaking. We were scared. I could barely drive. You know, words just cannot express the sheer terror and fear that we felt. I've been in other situations where people were shooting and we had to run. It's just so sad that we cannot feel safe in our own Black neighborhoods. We want to support businesses. We want to support things that people are doing, but we always have to think safety. You know, where is this event going to be? Is it a house party? What time is it going to be at? What neighborhood is it in? Is this a good area? You know, who's going to be there? When you have these experiences with gun violence, it changes you. It affects how you operate and how you move in the world. You think about the experiences. It's stressful. It's traumatic. You know, the same thing with Ricky Smiley. After he got shot, he said, you know, eventually his body healed physically. He was able to go back to work and he had made all these different accomplishments. But mentally, he was rattled. Mentally, he wasn't the same. He didn't like being out after dark. He was always alert to who was approaching him and who was standing nearby him. You know, he was feeling very fearful and angry all the time. And he went on to achieve more success than he could have ever dreamed of. And after all those great accomplishments, all those great moments, all the great love that he experienced after the trauma happened to him, being shot still stayed with him. He said all the success that he had still could not wipe away the memory of the night he was shot. And not only is he affected by the memory of being shot, he still has physical issues that came about from being shot. Like they weren't able to remove the buckshots from his elbow because that would have caused him nerve damage. So he still has buckshots in his elbow and it hurts him to rest his left elbow on a table. So he has to adjust his arm and he has to move the buckshot around so that he can be in comfort. You know, and then the buckshots in his elbow, they also affect the strength in his left hand. And doctors told him that he will eventually develop arthritis. So, you know, and he had to have multiple surgeries to repair his large and small intestines. And the doctor told him that he may have to spend the rest of his life with a colonoscopy bag. You know, he didn't have to end up doing that, but he still has buckshots still left in his side because removing them would have caused more damage. And when he has his annual physical exams and they do x-rays, he feels embarrassed, he said, because he has to explain to them why he has buckshots in his body. And, you know, he said he was just angry. He lived in fear for a long time. Anytime he saw a Caprice Classic with tinted windows roll by, he felt terrified. Even though the man that shot him was in prison, because that was the car that the man who shot him, that's the kind of car that he drove. When Ricky Smiley would drive by those type of cars, he would check to make sure his doors are locked and he'd try to speed away. So all those years later, you know, if he didn't have a comedy show to do or something for work, then he doesn't leave the house after 6 p.m. because of fear stemming from when he got shot. He doesn't stop at red lights. He slows down in the middle of the block, he said, and he'll time the light. So by the time he gets to the corner, the light is already green, and then he'll speed through it. You know, his life has changed a lot as a result of gun violence. You know, even right now, if he's out of town and he's performing out of town and he gets paid in cash, he doesn't let the promoter know who he's riding with. He provides his own transportation and he goes out the side door and he slides out quick and he disappears. He said he's never embraced the celebrity flashy type of lifestyle. Like he never put rims on his car. He doesn't wear jewelry. He vanishes and he'll get out of Dodge. So you see how if you survive, you have to live with the effects of gun violence for the rest of your life. And I think it's important too to point out that, you know, white people's experience of gun violence is often very different from Black people's experiences of gun violence. Like gun violence for white people in America, it's seen as a social problem. It's seen as a public health issue. But for Black people, it's not seen as a social problem. It's seen as a Black problem. So then mainstream society doesn't show interest or care about the issue. And the media and the news, they have a lot to do with that because the news will show Black people as perpetrators of community violence, but rarely as victims. So they don't show a balanced and positive picture of Black life in America all the time. You know, in politics and the history of racism, it has a lot to do with it too. Like, you know, when white men perpetrate gun violence, like say they die by suicide or they commit a mass shooting, it's treated as a public health problem. And they'll say, oh, he did it because of a mental illness and because of stress. But when a black man perpetrates gun violence, it's seen as a criminal issue. And they'll say he did it because he has no morals. He has no conscience. He's just somebody that doesn't respect the law. And the media will make comments that insinuate that gun violence in black communities is just because of black on black crime, just because black people want to kill each other. And that whole statement about black on black crime is rooted in systematic oppression. It's rooted in racism and it's bias. You know, it's just like basically saying, oh, that's black on black crime. That's their problem. That's a black thing. They need to fix that on their own. When the truth of the matter is, white people commit crimes against white people. Asian people commit crimes against Asian people. Native Americans against Native Americans. Hispanic people against Hispanic people, and so on. And that's because most people commit crimes where they live. And because we live in segregated neighborhoods in the United States, we have black neighborhoods, we have white neighborhoods, we have Asian neighborhoods, we have Hispanic neighborhoods, people of the same race commit crimes against each other. So it's a stereotype and it's discriminatory to say black on black crime. Why do we only hear the term black on black crime? We don't hear white on white crime. We don't hear Asian on Asian crime, Hispanic on Hispanic crime. All races are doing the same thing, committing crimes against their race. It just all goes back to racism, racist theories about black people. There are people of every race who do really bad things. And I'm not saying all this to say that we don't have a problem in the black community, because we do. We most definitely do. But I just want to share this info to clear up any misconceptions and give explanations so that we can see the total picture and see the whole scope of the problem. You know, almost 3,000 children are shot and killed every year in the United States, and 10 times more black children die from guns than white children. Black children fall victim to gun violence, and they're exposed to gun violence at higher rates than any other ethnicity. So yes, we have a problem. Yes. And our black children are witnessing shootings at school, in the community, at home, and it's affecting them in terms of, you know, they are at increased risk of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. They're at increased risk of having difficulty in school. It increases their risk of them engaging in criminal activity themselves. They're at increased risk of using drugs and using alcohol. And in black communities, when there is a high rate of gun violence, they are normally in, you know, impoverished communities, because people don't want to build businesses there. Home values depreciate and people start to move out of the area. And then the families of survivors and victims of gun violence, they end up having financial problems, like they can't pay their rent, they can't pay the gas bill, the lights, their phone bill, because of the family member can't work because they got shot, or a family member can't work because now they have to take care of the person that got shot, and then they have to deal with the high medical bills, and then there's no jobs in the community because people aren't putting businesses there. You know, the homicide rate for black people in America, in all 50 states, it's 8 times higher than the homicide rate for white people. If we look at the United States in general, Americans are 128 times more likely to be killed by everyday gun violence than by international terrorism. And if we break that down to black people are specifically 500 times more likely to die by gun violence, 500 times more likely. So yes, we have a problem. Black people are experiencing trauma of, from gun violence to such an extent that we're not able to cope. These are stressful and traumatic events, and they greatly affect our mental state and our quality of life. But guess what? We don't get help. We don't get treatment. We develop habits. We go through all these emotional changes, and if, instead of going to therapy or to a doctor, we find ways to cope that are maladaptive, that are not good for us, like drinking to cope with your problems. And then what happens is that all of these emotional problems and all of these negative ways that we handle our problems, it just gets passed down from generation to generation, and nobody gets help. So it's important that we talk about these issues. You know, that's why I started this podcast, because I want to be able to help us to start breaking some of these generational trauma bonds that we have. We need to be able to heal as a community so we can heal our families. We can heal individually. We can learn how to deal with distressing situations in healthy ways. You know, we can understand mental health issues better, and we can help the people that are around us, and we can understand them. Like, you know, when people get shot or they have traumatic experiences, we don't always know what they're dealing with. We don't know what to say. We don't know what could be going on in their head. When you're a victim of gun violence, or when you're a witness of it, or you experience gun violence and you start to feel certain things, you start to think a certain way, you don't understand it. And you don't have anybody to tell you that that's normal. You don't have anybody to tell you why this is happening. And we just continue on with life, and we try to just figure things out, and nothing gets resolved. Things get worse. So it's important for us to talk about these issues. You know, as a result of getting shot, of personally knowing someone who has been shot, seeing someone get shot, you know, having guns pulled on you, or constantly being exposed to violence, and just having that fear of personal harm that Black people face on a regular basis, many of us, we go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And Black people develop PTSD, like I said earlier, from so many different things, not just gun violence. And I'll talk about many of the other topics, such as childhood sexual abuse, you know, domestic violence, health conditions. It could be racial trauma, rape, sexual assault. I'm going to talk about those topics in future episodes, you know, but today I just wanted to focus on trauma in regards to gun violence in the Black community. And, you know, every Black person does not develop PTSD. Some people are exposed to trauma and they won't develop PTSD. But there is some research that has shown that one out of every 10 Black people becomes traumatized. You know, we hear this term PTSD, PTSD. We hear that all the time. You know, Fantasia, she just wrote a song called PTSD. She's talking about love, though. You know, she just took PTSD and turned it into something else. But post-traumatic stress disorder is what PTSD is. And I think that we hear the word and we don't really know everything that comes with it. Like, what exactly is PTSD and what happens when somebody has it? And it's complex. It's a mental health condition. And it comes about, though, when somebody is exposed to death, or the threat of death, or they're faced with serious injury or sexual violence. And when I say exposed, you know, that means that you directly had it happen to you. You witnessed it in person. So not on a movie, you didn't see it on TV, you didn't see it on social media. You saw it in person happening to somebody else. Or maybe you learned that it happened to a close family member or a close friend. And if it happened to a close friend or a family member, it had to be something that was violent or accidental that happened. And it also comes about too, like if you have had repeated and extreme exposure to traumatic events like Black people do in the Black community, or like first responders do. Like, they're constantly having to collect human remains and they're seeing dead people and picking up dead bodies. Or like police officers. A lot of police officers have PTSD because they're seeing dead bodies. They're collecting, you know, they're taking these reports about child abuse and they're repeatedly exposed to the details of child abuse. So what happens when people have PTSD is that they might keep having memories about the trauma. It keeps popping in their head. So like, they got shot, they've healed, maybe some time has passed, but when they're eating breakfast, the memory just pops up in their head of when they got shot, just out of nowhere. You know, they're at work and the memory just pops up in their head out of nowhere. Same thing that happened to Ricky Smiley. You know, when they're on a date, the memory might just pop up in their head. You know, it's intrusive. It keeps happening and you don't have any control over it. People will have nightmares. They have bad dreams. You'll see that a lot with kids, kids who are traumatized. They'll have a lot of bad dreams and they may not be able to tell you what the dream was about. They're just really scared when they wake up. And it's something that will happen often. People with PTSD will also have flashbacks. And the flashbacks are to the point to where they might feel like they're being shot again, or that they're seeing it happen again. So they go into this like anxiety. They might not even be aware of their surroundings and what's happening around them, because their mind just goes into this mode. And they might see somebody who looks like the person that shot them, or looks like the person that they saw shot somebody. So when that happens, it causes them a lot of distress. Or, you know, if they hear fireworks, it causes distress because it sounds like gunshots and it triggers people. So in order not to think about what happened to them, or to avoid memories, people avoid and they try to push away their emotions by drinking. They'll do drugs. They'll throw themselves into work and just be really, really busy. Or they might be on social media a lot and text messaging to avoid their thoughts. So, you know, people get into romantic relationships to avoid dealing with themselves, or they stay away from intimacy and they start to distance themselves from people when they have PTSD. And not only do they do things to avoid their thoughts and emotions, you know, they're not just avoiding what's happening internally. They'll do things like avoid people. They'll avoid places, conversations, you know, objects and situations, anything that reminds them about what happened. You know, it could be sounds, it could be smells, physical symbols. So say somebody got shot outside of a hamburger stand on 20th Street and they were wearing a gray shirt when they got shot. So now after they got shot, they don't drive on 20th Street at all. They will go 30 minutes out of their way to avoid that street by driving in a different direction to get to their destination. You know, they don't go to hamburger stands. If they smell a burger, they might try to get away from the smell. They don't wear gray shirts anymore. If they were with their friend at the time, they may be avoiding talking to them now or being around them because they are a reminder of this traumatic thing that happened to them. Anything that reminds them of what happened, they will avoid, like watching movies where somebody is getting shot. That's triggering. Like I said, fireworks. They might stay in the house and put headphones on the 4th of July, or just try to go to bed early. Maybe they were on the way to play basketball when they got shot, or when the traumatic thing happened. So now they don't want to play basketball. They can't see a basketball. They can't watch it on TV because it brings up memories of what happened. You know, and a lot of times people, they don't want to talk about what happened. So when other people are talking about somebody that got shot, or they might be asking them about what happened when they got shot, they will avoid that conversation. They might leave the room. They might get very upset. And the thing about avoidance is that it helps in the short term, but it's a temporary fix. So it might help them to feel better for a little while, but it's going to come back up. And it's going to keep coming back up until you deal with it and get some help. So that's the same thing like Ricky Smiley was saying. You know, he's going to see a therapist because this stuff is just coming up because he hasn't completely dealt with it. And there's certain therapy treatments that specifically deal with PTSD, and they can help people. So, you know, with PTSD, sometimes people have memory problems and they can't remember important details or aspects about what happened to them. Or they might start to have negative beliefs about themselves and about the world. And these beliefs are like extreme. They're exaggerated. Like they might feel like because this thing happened to me, that means I'm bad. I'm a bad person. You know, the whole world is dangerous. It's just completely unsafe out here and I can't go anywhere or do anything. You know, sometimes people feel emotionally numb. People have problems with sleeping. So they'll have problems falling asleep. They have problems staying asleep. They might be just very restless when they're sleeping. And people with PTSD, they have difficulty concentrating. They might be feeling jumpy or easily startled. Like I have that problem. I don't have PTSD, but I have that problem. I am scary. Like I'm always jumpy. Somebody can easily startle me. Like I know that you're there, but yet I'm jumping like, you know, you scared me. So I'm not ashamed to say I do have that problem. Sometimes when people have PTSD too, though, you know, you'll notice that they are very irritated. They have anger outbursts. So they might be yelling and arguing all the time. They might be physically aggressive and hitting people, fighting, throwing things. Sometimes people get really reckless and they're out doing self-destructive behaviors like drinking, drugs, driving fast, going out with a gun, riding around, or getting into it with people, or trying to get revenge. They might engage in problematic behaviors like gambling, compulsive sex, and compulsive pornography use, or even binge eating, or starving themselves, or self-injurious behavior like cutting themselves, burning themselves. And like I said, you know, thoughts get distorted. They start thinking about why this happened to them, and they'll start to blame themselves, and they'll blame other people for why this happened. And if I wasn't wearing that gray shirt, this wouldn't have happened. And that's probably not true. You know, it's a distorted thought. Some people are just in a constant negative emotional state too when they have PTSD. Like, they're feeling guilt all the time. They're feeling shame. They're feeling anger, fear, horror, and they don't want to do anything that they used to enjoy. Like, they might be distant and detached from people. So a lot of times too, they may not feel any positive emotions. Like, they don't feel happy. They don't feel loving feelings or satisfaction. And another thing you'll notice with people who have PTSD, like, they're very, what we call hypervigilant. So, like, you know how people say they got their head on a swivel. So they'll be looking all around when they go out. You might be out with them and they can't relax. They're watching everybody and everything, and they don't want anybody sitting behind them or standing behind them. They have to sit with their chair against the wall, facing the door. Sometimes with kids, they'll just stop talking, and they have this loss of language. They developmentally regress. With kids also, you might see them playing and reenacting the trauma. So they might be playing with a toy gun and shooting it and falling on the ground and just replaying what they saw and saying things that they heard the person say who got shot, or something that the person who shot them said, you know, help me, or whatever else. So traumatized kids will often act out what they saw while they're playing. And you know, a really good example of that is this show called The Wire. It came on HBO, and it's fresh in my mind because I just finished watching it during this quarantine. And there was a character on there, and his name was Omar. And Omar, he carried around a sawed off shotgun, and he would go and he was robbing the drug dealers, and he would be, you know, shooting the drug dealers. People see Omar coming and they know that Omar about to do some damage. So Omar had killed like some people, and I guess some kids that were outside, they saw Omar do it and they saw everything unfold. So when the police came, they weren't even paying attention to the kids. The kids were outside playing, and the kids were like running around like with fake guns, and they were saying like, I'm Omar. Omar said blah, blah, blah. And they reenacted basically what they saw. And so that was a good example of traumatized kids. You know, you might think that they're just playing, but if you listen and you look at what they're doing, they are reenacting the trauma that they experienced. It's also important to know that when people have PTSD, they might be suicidal. They're thinking of killing themselves. They might be planning it. They might attempt to kill themselves. And people with PTSD are 80% more likely to have depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety, substance use disorders. So PTSD is a severe condition. There's a lot that's going on when somebody is experiencing symptoms of PTSD. And it's not just, you know, PTSD isn't that uncle that came from the war and now he's at home and he's acting strange, or that he's waking up in the middle of the night strangling his wife. Like, there's some other examples of PTSD besides that. And I feel like we have been given that image and that view of it for so long, it's hard to recognize or consider that people who have not been into the military also experience PTSD. We need to be able to recognize it in young Black men, in Black women, in Black children, in the Black community, period. And like I said before, everyone who experiences trauma doesn't end up developing PTSD, because there's certain criteria that needs to be met in order to call it PTSD. But still, even experiencing trauma does cause people to have a lot of these same symptoms, especially in the Black community. I want people to know that, you know, there is no right way to handle trauma. Everyone is different and they move at their own pace, and they decide when they're ready to deal with the pain and confront the pain. You know, healing from trauma, it's a process, and there's no timeline. There's no way to hurry up and get through it. Unfortunately, as human beings, we are going to go through some pain. we are going to go through some suffering, some worse than others, and some that are senseless and could have been prevented. We all go through pain and loss. For some, it's just immense. But over time, the intensity of the emotional pain, it will lessen, it will reduce. But in the meantime, what we can control and what we can prevent is the suffering, is the long suffering. You know, because in the Black community, we suffer greatly, and we suffer for long periods of time, and we don't have to. We can prevent having to suffer on top of the pain. Let me tell you how. You know what time it is. It's time to cope. It's time to pull out our coping toolboxes. I'm going to give us some tools to toss in there today to help us cope and heal from trauma. Remember, we are going to be building this coping toolbox, you know, every time that we're together. So you're going to keep everything that we need that can calm us during times of distress and help us to express how we feel in healthy ways. Now, most of the time, when people go through traumatic experiences, they may have a difficult time coping, a difficult time adjusting to what's happened to them. So with time, though, and with good self-care, they usually get better. But if the symptoms get worse and they last for months or years, or they interfere with a person's day-to-day functioning, they might have PTSD. And if that's the case, it's important to get treatment, effective treatment, you know, to see a therapist, see a psychiatrist. And, you know, there is nothing wrong with needing mental health services. There's no reason to feel ashamed. It's important. It's an important form of self-care. You know, like I said in other episodes, it's the same thing. When people have mental health issues, it's the same thing as having a physical health issue. You have diabetes, you got to get treatment for it. You got to get medication. You got to change your diet. You got to do XYZ. You get cancer. There's certain things that you have to do in order to improve, or, you know, to treat it. And the same thing with mental health conditions, PTSD. There are certain things that you have to do to treat it so that you can improve your symptoms, so you can improve your functioning, so you can improve your quality of life. If you are somebody that you know has had a traumatic experience and you're having trouble getting your life back under control, you know, you're having disturbing thoughts, you're having feelings about this traumatic event that happened, and it's you've been feeling this way for more than a month and it's severe, then you need to go and talk to a doctor. Talk to your primary care doctor. They can refer you to somebody. You know, talk to a mental health professional. Get treatment as soon as possible so that you can prevent the symptoms from getting worse. And if you don't know where to go get help, like I said, you can speak with your primary care doctor, your physician. You know, you can talk to somebody at church on the clergy, because these days, you know, a lot of our churches are working with the local Department of Mental Health. So they have different programs that they're a part of, and they're able to refer people from churches to a lot of the mental health places in the community. So you can talk to somebody at church and find out how you can get help in the community. You can also go onto my Instagram. I posted some resources and there's information there about where to get help. So you can go on to at Dr. Tina Webb on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. That's DrTinaWebb. If you or somebody that you know is having suicidal thoughts, please get help. Please get help right away. Reach out to a close friend. Talk to a loved one. Contact, you know, a spiritual leader or a minister or somebody in your faith community. You can also call the suicide hotline number. It's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, 24 hours a day. You can call and you can talk to a trained counselor. Now, the number to call is 800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255. It's, you know, you can remember it like this too. 1-800-273-TALK. And you can, like I said, talk with a trained counselor. And you can also use that same number and go ahead and press 1, and you can get to the Veterans Crisis Line if you are a veteran or somebody you know who is struggling is a veteran. And make an appointment. Make an appointment with your doctor or with a mental health professional so you can get help. You know, if those urges are strong and you feel like you are going to hurt yourself, you're going to kill yourself, you're going to attempt suicide, call 911. call 911, call your local emergency number immediately so that they can send some help to you. If you know someone who's in danger of attempting suicide, you know, they've made a suicide attempt before, make sure someone stays with that person to keep him or her safe. Call 911. Or if you can and you can do it safely, get that person to the nearest hospital emergency room immediately. And, you know, if you're going to be driving them, just be careful, you know, make sure, because people will try to jump out of the car when they're suicidal while the car is moving. So you just have to be careful with that option if that's something that you plan to do. You know, when people survive a traumatic event, it's normal at first for them to, you know, not be able to stop thinking about what happened, for them to have fear and anxiety and anger and depression and guilt. All of those are common reactions to trauma. Now, like I said before, the majority of people exposed to trauma, they don't always develop like long-term post-traumatic stress disorder. So sometimes people don't need to go to therapy or they don't need any professional help. What helps some people is that they can talk with their friends and family. You know, they'll listen to them. They offer them support and comfort. So that might be an option if it's not PTSD. But if you wait too long and it develops into PTSD, you're going to need professional help. And therapy doesn't have to be long. You know, it doesn't have to be this long, drawn out, long process. Sometimes it could be just brief. It could be a couple weeks that you need help. So just keep that in mind as well. And when people get support from other people, you know, that can help you from developing unhealthy coping styles like using drugs and alcohol. It can deter you because you have some support and you have somebody that you're talking to about what you're dealing with. So that's why it's good to have support. And when people get treatment for PTSD, you know, it can be a combination of therapy and medication. Both of those treatments can help, but some people don't get medication and they just do the therapy. So it just depends. You'll talk about that with your doctor and your mental health team to see what it is that you need. So what happens in therapy is that people start to learn skills to help address their symptoms. And like I told you how you have distorted thoughts and stuff when people go through trauma, they'll have these distorted thinking about the world, about themselves. So therapy kind of helps you to think better of yourself. It helps you to filter through those distorted thoughts and you'll start to see the world differently so that you can get back out there. And, you know, you learn ways to cope. You learn ways to deal with it if some of these symptoms come back. So you already have these skills built up. You know, like our coping toolbox that we're building right now, you know, and therapy, it also helps to treat other problems that are related, like depression, anxiety. You know, people are misusing drugs. So therapy will help you address that, the drug use, the alcohol use. It's important for people to not try to handle the burden of PTSD and trauma on their own. Talk to family, talk to friends, talk to a professional. You need support to get through this. Also in therapy, people learn stress management techniques, ways to handle stressful situations and to cope with life stress. And then there's also just different treatments that are available to treat PTSD, specific treatments that can help people. And when I say treatment, I mean, there's different types of therapy, like there's cognitive therapy, there's prolonged exposure therapy, there's EDMR, there's just all these different ones to treat trauma. You know, there's medication, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications that people can get. And, you know, you would talk to your doctor about all of these things. You and your treatment team, you'll come up with a plan together of what's the best option for you. If you are taking any medications, tell your doctor about any side effects or any problems with the medication. You know, I mentioned to you about suffering and about how to not suffer on top of the pain. Some of the things that can help you with that is just to have continuous contact and support from the people in your life that are important to you. You know, tell your loved ones about the trauma. Tell them this happened to me. They may not know what just happened, that you was at the store a couple of weeks ago and somebody pulled a gun out on you. Let them know. You know, identify yourself as a survivor as opposed to a victim. I'm a survivor of gun violence. I'm a survivor of this or that. Not I'm a victim of it. Take back your strength and your power. You know, Use positive emotions. Laugh. Try to watch things that bring that emotion out of you, things that kind of make you happy. So you have to make a conscious effort to do these things to bring out this positive emotion and laughter within yourself. Try to find if a lot of people find positive meaning in the trauma, like Meg Thee Stallion. She said, you know, she hates that this had to happen, but it was a blessing in disguise because the incident taught her how to protect her energy. It taught her how to moving forward. So, you know, people find different meanings in different things. So you can find meaning as well sometimes, you know, and then also helping other people to heal in their process, you know, especially when you start to open up and you tell family members or you tell people what's happened to you, they're going to open up to you too at sometimes, and they will let you know what's happened to them, and you might be able to help them in their healing process. And that helps both of you to not suffer. You can go to support groups, and that also helps people. You can sit there, you can listen to other people, their experiences. You can share your experiences, and it's a healing process. And I want you to believe that you can manage your feelings. I want you to believe that you can cope. You know, put it in your head. I believe you can do it. Believe in yourself that you can manage these feelings, that you can cope with this trauma that has happened to you. And the reason that I say that I believe you can do it is because I've seen it. I've seen it so many times. I've worked with so many people, and they come in, they're traumatized. They come in, they're depressed. They come in, they have anxiety. They come in and they're in different states, so many different states and so many different things that are happening. And they feel like they're never going to get better. And then guess what? They do. They do get better. They come in and they're smiling. They come in, they've started to do some of the activities and the things they used to enjoy again. They're able to control these emotions and these thoughts from just popping up in their head. And when the thoughts do pop up, they're able to control the emotion that's behind it. I've seen it. I've witnessed the healing. You do not have to suffer. There is support, there is help, and there is life after trauma. I just want to say that, you know, while we must continue to fight for justice and for our civil rights in regards to police brutality and police violence, we also have another movement that needs to come about as well. And we have to address the issue of gun violence in our Black communities. You know, this senseless gun violence has to stop. It victimizes our families, the Black community, and our future generations, because our babies are dying. Kids are being left without parents. Grandparents are being killed. A bullet doesn't have a name on it. The cemetery is full of Black lives, Black talented, beautiful people who never got a chance, who never got a chance. They're laying in a casket because of gun violence. So we got to start making some changes. And that's all the tools I got. So go ahead and put those toolboxes away. It's time for my favorite part of the show, y'all. Movie therapy, music therapy. I'd like to dedicate today's episode to the song called Changes by Tupac. And the song says, I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm Black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, kill it, he's a hero. Get a crack to the kids, who the hell cares? One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship them dope, let them deal the brothers. Give them guns, step back, watch them kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brother, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I love to go back to when we played as kids, but things change. And that's the way it is. We gotta make a change. It's time for us as a people to start making some changes. Let's change the way we eat. Let's change the way we live, and let's change the way we treat each other. You see, the old way wasn't working, so it's on us to do what we got to do to survive. I believe that. I receive that. And I mean that. It's coping season, y'all. Thank you for joining me this week. I hope you all enjoyed this episode. You are not only listeners, you are my co-hosts, and we are a community. And I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your stories, experiences, and thoughts related to life issues, topics you'd like to hear discussed, or questions you'd like answered. Please visit me on the web at drtinaweb.com and click on Ask Dr. Tina to submit your questions, thoughts, and more. Tune in every Wednesday to hear my response. You can also check out the show notes as well as other contact information on the website. In the meantime and in between time, for additional updates, conversations, and more ways to interact, please connect with me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Dr. Tina Webb. That's DrTinaWebb. Feel free to share your thoughts from the show on social media using the hashtag Coping Season Podcast. Lastly, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you are listening to help others find the show and learn to cope just like you. I appreciate and read every single review. Thank you so much for listening to the show and for spreading the word to all of your friends, family, and coworkers. I so appreciate it. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.